Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to spend a lot of time with animals this morning. We're starting out at the Coors Farm Dairy in Whitingham, and at 10 we'll speak with Dr. Bradley Temple about why wait times for veterinarians have increased. And we'll finish meeting a Vermonter who took two golds in equestrian events in Montreal in 1976. At 9:30, we'll speak with Marine veteran Jason Moselle about how running ultramarathons have helped his mental health. But first, let's head to the Coors family farm, the farm dairy. Joining us is Abby Coors, who is currently a member of the Vermont Climate Council. So we're going to talk about dairy farming and climate change this morning. Abby Coors, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Abby about dairy farming today or about the Climate Council, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Abby, give us a little history about the farm that you and your parents manage.
Okay, so we are, as you said, in Whitingham, Vermont, which, for those who don't know, is in what my father refers to as the Forgotten Kingdom. We're literally a border town. Mm-hmm. We're about 5 minutes from Massachusetts. And we are at 2,000 feet. And we have been here since 1868. And the sort of interesting thing, I guess, about our operation is that it is a dairy grazing operation, and has always been that. So we have been grazing animals on perennial grasses since 1868. Mm. So we ship milk to Organic Valley. We are a conserved farm easement through the Vermont Land Trust, and we are fully solar powered. So that's a little bit of a grounding, I guess, in our operation down here.
And we should mention, for those who don't know, Whitingham, the birthplace of Brigham Young as well.
Indeed. It also contains the second largest earthen dam in the world and a floating island.
Really?
Yeah.
I always think I know everything about Vermont, and I'm so glad I've learned something new. I've got to make a trip back to Whitingham sometime soon now.
Happy to help.
Okay, good. Now, Abby, was dairy farming something you always wanted to do?
No, never. No.
Thanks for your honesty.
My degree is in journalism. I graduated from St. Mike's. And I worked in arts administration before I came back to the farm, and I swore my whole life I would never farm, and realized once I left, as I think a certain percentage of farm kids do, that sort of the rhythms of this life were so deeply ingrained in my being that once separated from them, I felt very adrift. And, realized that, I wanted to raise my kids near my parents, and I get the stewardship of this land base that my family has had the privilege to partake in for so many generations now with something that I didn't know how to leave behind. And so I have been back since 2008, and we've just been in our way through kind of the challenges that come of a woman and a mother trying to take over a business that's never been run by one person and all the challenges that ensue from that.
Boy, your story reminds me of Chester Abbott in Randolph, also an organic dairy farmer. And, same thing. No way, never going to do that. And then found his way back to the farm and loves it. What are the positive aspects of being on a dairy farm, especially for the family and the children?
I just think it's, I think you have access to a different type of learning than we currently have access to a lot in this society. And I do think that that is a privilege. You know, the average person is 3 to 4 generations removed from the farm. And I think you hear in the younger generations the sorrow or the loss that's felt by feeling disconnected from a land base and from the natural world. And I don't know, I just think it imparts a different type of wisdom, and I really wanted my kids to have that sort of, you know, even when I was gone from here traveling, and I was always a very rooted person, and I think that that can be directly attributed to how I was brought up here and what we have here in this close family environment. And I really thought, my husband and I really thought that that was something that we wanted to have for our kids. And I used to hate cows, but I now love them, and I have fun with them. They're like big puppies, you know? so they're, you know, they all have names and personalities, yeah, and lineage, and it feels, you know, when you're managing a farm system and an organic one specifically with sort of the parameters that we have, you're just so a part of a larger ecosystem and watershed and really grounded in that. And I just think it helps place things in perspective a bit differently, and I really treasure that.
How big is the farm? How big is the herd?
So our milking herd is about 50. We raise all of our young stock here, so we have about 90 animals total, and the farm base is 300 acres, about 100 of open land and 200 of forest, and then we steward another 200 or so acres from 26 landlords to get in our crops, our hay.
So you have hay. Do you ship, do you just ship milk, or do you have other dairy products,
We do. I mean, it's funny. It kind of depends on your definition of diversification. This used to be a very traditional hill farm in that we had a maple operation and a dairy, mm-hmm, and those businesses we split off a number of years ago, and my uncle manages the sugaring operation, and my parents and I manage the dairy. And so we're diversified in our dairy in the sense that we have a market for cull cows, and so we do produce organic beef, and we sell a lot of hay in years when drought isn't a factor. And we also sell, you know, calves and some young stock and things like that. So, but it is an actual true dairy farm, which is pretty rare at this point because of the lack of economic viability for that.
Well, let's talk about that. The number of dairy farms continues to decline in Vermont. So how has, yeah, you know, the Coors Farm Dairy been able to persevere?
Well, I think some people don't like my answer to this, but and it's taken some years, I think, for my poor father to come to this place too, because I don't want to lie and say that there hasn't been an immense amount of hard work and grit and determination, but a lot of it is a lot of privilege and a lot of luck. My dad was paying really close attention to the market trends, and we transitioned to organic at just the right time. Without shipping to Organic Valley, we would be out of business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's inherited land. We don't have debt because of how long we've been in business. And I think, you know, when you're thinking about particularly beginning or new farmers, you know, dairy is incredibly capital intensive. And so just the upfront start costs are quite insane. So kind of a lot of luck at this point, and straight up, I don't know.
Well, good decision. Luck is the residue of design, and your father did make the right call at the right time to transition to organic. Did that happen, and what does it take to transition to organic? It's not just flipping the switch.
No. I mean, it's very, just like everything in the farm world, and I think this is something that I wish was more commonly understood. You know, each farmstead is so individual. You know, even down to the types of soils that you have and therefore what types of crops you can grow and et cetera. So my dad called me. I was working at the Flynn Center at the time. I can still remember it. I was sitting in my cubicle there, and my dad called and said, you know, I went to a procurement meeting for Organic Valley, and I'm really thinking that organic is the way for us to go. We were basically already there, so our transition was a little bit less intensive than some. We had to do a three-year transition because we had used some conventional fertilizer on some of our fields, and so the land requires 3 years of a transition. And then the most crucial part is that the last year of the transition, the animals have to be managed entirely organically per certification, but you're getting the conventional milk price. And so it's incredibly difficult because organic grain costs twice as much, organic fertilizers cost twice as much. Actually, fertilizer is now up to almost four times as much as conventional for organic. And so the margins are nearly impossible, but it's like if you can make it through that last year, you're in a good spot. Mm-hmm. We were further complicated by literally almost exactly to the day of the year's start for transitioning our animals. Our barn was hit by lightning and burned.
Oh,
and we were very fortunate our animals weren't lost, but we had to move our animals 18 miles away to stay at another farm for, I want to say it was 6 weeks, that my parents drove 18 miles each way to milk the cows twice a day, you know, starting at 3 in the morning and then again at 3 in the afternoon to manage that organic transition. So it's not for the faint of heart.
No, it isn't. Abby, I do want to get to the Climate Council, but I just want to wrap up the idea of dairy farming in Vermont. What can Vermonters do to support our remaining dairy farms?
I think for those who have the privilege or the ability to think about their purchases, you know, the more local the purchase is, the better. I think one of the interesting things I've come to realize in the last few years is that there is a misconception around Organic Valley, for example, that it is not local milk, and it is. It's, you know, distributed, processed in Vermont and New Hampshire primarily, and distributed locally, you know, and regionally. And so I think that's something that I think there are a lot of things like that, but just the intricacies or inner workings of the food system are really opaque for a lot of people. And so, you know, supporting Organic Valley, for example, or buying Organic Valley products helps our family stay in business and a large number of other dairy farmers in the state. And then in addition, you know, it's continuing to buy and devour that delicious Cabot cheese. Seriously, Sharp is my personal favorite.
Yes, indeed.
you know, keeping up with your ice cream habit, all those different things.
All right. Those are excellent suggestions. and all three I do follow, so I'm happy to admit. All right.
Appreciate that. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, yeah. What were your thoughts now when the legislature passed the Global Solutions Act just over a year ago?
Well, I have to admit, I wasn't really following that all that closely. Somebody suggested that, you know, let me know that there was going to be a farm and forest sector representative, and it suggested that I apply. And so, you know, this was, I feel I need to make this really clear that this was a partnership decision on the part of our family farm. You know, my parents and I are very aware of climate change and are actively dealing with the repercussions and ramifications of it on a regular basis, have been for nearly a decade. And, you know, the voice of particularly the smaller farmer and the younger farmer is one that I don't think is well understood or necessarily well represented in a broad sense in our state. And so it seemed like this was a place where we could use some of the privilege that we have to try to add a bit more nuance and hopefully bring forward a different perspective than is sometimes represented at the table. And George Seaman, who was the former CEO of Organic Valley, always said in our leadership trainings, if you're not at the table, you're on it. and I think, you know, I just think that in general, we're in a moment where the people, you know, policy is often made in isolation of the people who actually have to carry it out. And it seemed really critical in a moment like this that somebody who is doing the work of carrying out those policies needed to be at the table.
When did the council?
I was chosen.
Oh, that's brilliant. When did the council first get together in some form, in person or virtually?
We actually have never gathered in person. We are a fully COVID-19 pandemic council. We have done all of this work on an insane timeline in Zoom rooms. There has been no in-person meetings of the actual council, which is a little bit wild to think about. And we began gathering in, I believe it was late November. So it's almost a year.
And when is the finished, agreed-upon plan need to be submitted?
It is due to the legislature December 1st, and so we are careening wildly towards the deadline.
And you met yesterday, am I correct about that?
Yes.
All right, and pretty much buttoning up the whole thing. So congratulations on getting that done.
Yeah, it's been quite something.
Is it close? Are you pretty close?
Yes, I believe, as far as I understand it, we are on target to deliver the plan by December 1st as requested. I do want to make clear that it is a draft plan. There is still a lot of public engagement that needs to be done. And then, you know, we need to figure out the process to incorporate that. But I do feel like it's always important to say that, you know, a lot of other states have engaged in this work, but none on this type of timeline. Mm. And to try to do this timeline in the pandemic through Zoom has been a wild ride.
And this plan is setting goals for like several years out.
Yes. So there's targets, proportional reduction targets for 2025, 2030, and 2050.
Wow. So what has your role been on the council, Abby?
So I am, as I said, the farm and forest sector representative on the actual Vermont Climate Council, which is a 23-member body. And then I am one of the co-chairs of the Agriculture and Ecosystem Subcommittee and, you know, tried in that space to bring a little bit of a different perspective forward in terms of thinking about, you know, what will be required for the people who need to do this work and for the ways that it can be done to, you know, for reciprocity for our land, for our natural environment and our natural resources, right? And so that's been a theme of how we've been trying to approach this this work in that committee.
So you want to make sure there's a dose of reality mixed in with grand plans. And
yes, that bluntly, yes. I think, you know, I think a lot of, I can only speak from a farmer perspective, right? But I think from a lot of farmers' perspective, the will is there to do what needs to be done, but the resources and the capacity aren't, mm-hmm. you know, the margins aren't there. The money isn't there, the energy, the time, the education. And so, you know, how can we, for all of the different workforces that are both going to be impacted by climate change and then are necessary to, you know, do the work that needs to be done, what do they need? You know, how can they be capacitated in order to support the benefit of our society as a whole moving forward?
As you mentioned, in a year's time, this all had to be done. You had to commit time to being in these Zoom calls. And how difficult was that, taking time out of a dairy operation to commit time to be part of this?
Well, this again is where I just need to highlight, we are extremely extremely privileged. And so my father was the first certified mentor grazer for the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship Program when it came to Vermont. There are now a number of others at the moment, but we've graduated two apprentices now, and our apprentice was utterly critical in making this possible. I have not milked cows this year. I also tore my rotator cuff, so I was not able to do much work, which is a whole other thing. But I think some people hear that, right? And there's this thought that I think even dairy farmers struggle with this too. You know, this thought that if you're not doing farm work all the time, then you're not a good farmer or not farmer enough. And I certainly have really struggled with that. But I've been helped along in that perspective by some folks who have said, you know, it's also really important that those of us that can get off the farm do in order to try to bring those voices to the table so that that perspective is represented. I mean, the people who have the knowledge to feed people is pretty critical. And, you know, food security is one of the first things that goes in climate change, as we can see when we examine the effects of it globally. And so, you know, it has taken an enormous toll on my father, to be completely honest. He has said, I believe in you doing this work, and so we will figure this out. But without our apprentice and my dad being a healthy 67-year-old, never could have pulled it off. The time commitment was something I just was entirely unprepared for what this would require.
I never thought of a dairy farmer getting injured, but I'm sure it happens, you know, more often.
It happens
than not,
a lot, and yeah. It's so interesting. I know this isn't really the point, but we have part of what I tried to do in the Agriculture and Ecosystems Subcommittee is talk about, you know, the difference between farm viability and farmer viability. You know, we don't invest, and this goes cross-sectorally, right? We don't really invest in our people. We invest in infrastructure.
Let's leave it there, and let's have you back to talk about that when you have a spare half hour again. I'd love to talk about that. Abby Course, organic dairy farmer, the Course Farm Dairy in Whitingham, established in 1868, and Abby is part of the Vermont Climate Council. Abby, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break, come back, and we'll talk with an ultramarathoning Marine veteran. This is Vermont Viewpoint.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Last Thursday was Veterans Day, and on Wednesday a friend told me about our next guest, but I only had a 15-minute time slot left in the show on Thursday, and I knew I needed more time for him to tell his story, so we're going to talk to him today. Jason Mozell served in the Marines, struggled with PTSD. It took its toll on this soldier, but he found an outlet to come back from the low points that he fought through. He ran, and he ran, and he ran. Jason Mozell joins us now to share what he's gone through, how he got through it, and how he helps others who face some of these same demons. Jason, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have a question for Jason or you want to share what you've experienced, you can give us a call. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jason, what motivated you to enter the military?
Really, it was 9/11. At the time, I was a junior in high school. The attacks on September 11th had just happened, and I always kind of correlated to for people in my generation that were around that age group, it was similar to, it was kind of like our Pearl Harbor. We got very motivated to join the military and to defend the freedoms of this country. And that was one of the big drivers to going to the Marine Corps. And a lot of us were kind of looking for, you know, the hardest branch, and so we went straight to the Marines.
Yeah, you did pick the hardest branch. I wondered why you chose the Marines. And, well done, Jason, for picking the hardest. How long did you serve?
I did my 4 years of active duty and then was honorably discharged in 2007.
And then any deployments?
I did two deployments over to Iraq and one to Okinawa, Japan.
Hmm. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you did experience PTSD. So what types of things, what types of experience brought that on?
That really came on after my first time going to Iraq. We went over to Iraq, to Ar-Ramadi, Iraq, in 2004. During that time, it was a very interesting time in the war on the military side of things, because it was kind of that transition from the initial push up through Iraq to what it kind of became. And so we went over with this mindset of just keeping everything stabilized, but we ended up in pretty hot and heavy fighting. And our battalion lost 34 Marines on that deployment. And one in particular from our platoon, and that's what affected me the most. So when I came home from that first deployment, I always say that I was physically back from the war, but not mentally. And around that, starting around that time, it's heavy drinking, it's not sleeping, it's being very short with friends and family and a lot of things like that. And it started to take this downward spiral from there.
How did family and friends react?
It was interesting, the wrong word, but it's the only word that comes to mind. And the reason why I call it interesting is there were some friends and family that showed concern and some friends and family that were not sure what to do. So it was more of the sense of, he's been to Iraq, he's been to war, this is normal. We've seen it with, you know, shell shock in World War One, and, you know, with veterans coming back from World War II, Vietnam, Korea. We see it all the time. This is kind of normal. So it was, yeah, Jay's different, but it's because he went to war. And so it was kind of, it was an interesting combination between what friends and family said.
And you then did another tour in Iraq. How was that, after you've already had PTSD from the first tour?
Yeah, and well, before we get to that side of it,
sure.
It's kind of this interesting, I use that word lightly, interesting. So I came back in 2004, struggled heavily. And again, it's kind of just putting everything under the rug with alcohol, and then was prescribed a plethora of medication. And while being deployed in 2005 to Okinawa, Japan, that was the time I attempted to take my own life. And at that time, the military had put me into a mental institution and was put on even more medication, more drugs, seeing psychiatrist after psychiatrist. And it was really limping my way along with alcohol and pills for the remainder of everything. And after Okinawa, we did deploy again over to Iraq. And I mean, it was a very strange time, because it's almost like you feel more felt more at home going there a second time, because you're still in this warrior type mindset.
Oh, wow.
And for myself, you're on these pills and all these things. And so like going over there the second time, it wasn't like there wasn't a thought in my head of anything, because it was just this odd feeling.
Wow. So at some point, you started to run. Tell us about, what got you started running? Because I don't think you were necessarily much of a high school athlete before that, correct?
No, not at all. In high school, I always explain it that the bulk of my physical activity in high school was playing hacky sack. I mean, I was not a stellar athlete or anything of that nature. Going into the Marine Corps, of course, there is running, there's hiking, there's some sort of physical activity, mm-hmm. but I mean, it is nothing like it is now for myself. So when I was honorably discharged from the Marines in 2007, myself and my wife, Amber, we were both out in California where I was stationed. We came back, drove across country, found a place in Barrie, Vermont, and you know, we just started to live our post-military lives. And it was interesting because we were both excited in the sense of, like, this is going to be kind of the start of our lives and, you know, put the war behind us type deal. But it never went away. And all of the same, you're not sleeping, you're drinking, your pills, and everything was still constantly there. And it just kept progressively getting worse because now you're out of the military and you're so far kind of disconnected from that community, that brotherhood and sisterhood that you had.
Right.
Now you're alone. And it was from 2007 to roughly 2013, it was a pretty dark struggle with myself. And in 2013, I had a friend of mine come up and said, you know, there's this new obstacle course race that we heard about called Tough Mudder. Mm-hmm. And it's a 10-mile course, 20-year-plus obstacles. Let's go see what it's all about. And we did it, and I got my stuff kicked in. And, you know, it was crossing the finish line, though, I started to, like, get this feeling, that community feeling, that sense of accomplishment. Like, it was this small little spark ignited in me.
After 6 years, you know, you said 2007 to 2013. That's a long, hard time that you had been through.
It was. It was a long, long, long time. I mean, a long 6 years, yeah. Like heavily drinking. I mean, there was a lot going on in that time frame.
Yeah.
And, but what it came down to was that in 2013, doing that race, and then, you know, between the years of 2013 and 2015 was kind of this transitional period in my life, in my mindset, and my growth.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of off and on where I did the Tough Mudder, felt this sense of accomplishment, said, all right, you know, we're going to get into X, Y, and Z, kind of go back into drinking. And then, you know, started with these at home DVDs called Insanity, and would kind of be on and off with that. And then what had happened in 2015 was I finally looked in the mirror and I told myself, look, we can discuss every reason why you are the way you are, why you drink, why you have nightmares, why you can't sleep, why you're agitated all the time. And we can point outwards to all of these external factors, whether it's Iraq, the Marines, family, friends, all these things. But at the end of the day, I have this demon in my head and it's not going anywhere. It's set up shop. It's there until the day you die. So I have two options. I can continue on the path that I was going, or I can make that demon pay rent every day that lives in my mind. And how rent is paid is through hard work. So once I made that transition, once I made that click, then it was every day we're going to wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning, somewhere around that time, and we're going to do a workout, and then we're going to run. And we're always going to make that demon pay rent. And quit drinking, quit the pills. And that is where that transition happened. And not to jump like way ahead, because, you know, this is going to sound like an easy transition, which it wasn't. It's been many years in the making. But, you know, what started with we're going to do at-home workouts in the basement at 3 in the morning every day. We're going to run a 5K every day. Has transitioned into doing more obstacle course races, into doing more endurance races, then into ultra races, like the 100-miler, 50-milers, 100-milers. Then that transitioned to 200-mile runs. And that transitioned into last May, me completing a 551-mile race. And that was the progression throughout the year since 2015.
I'm gobsmacked by how you have turned this around. I love the phrase, make the demon pay rent. Jason, running is one thing. I peaked at a 10K, a very slow 10K. When did you start to realize that you could really push the limits of running and start doing these marathons and ultramarathons? And we'll get to that thing you called 551 miles. I don't even know what the label is for that. But when did you know you could, like, go beyond?
That's kind of the great thing about it. You don't. It's always a question. I started to ask myself, where I completed, let's say, a 5K. All right. Can I do 10? Right. And then you complete a 10K. Okay. Can I do a half marathon? And it just progressively goes on from there. And always trying to push that limit, because as I had said earlier, that phrase that mantra that I live by now, where you make it pay rent.
Yeah, it's a high rent district now for that demon, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's very similar to a landlord that has an apartment building or anything like that, and then inflation hits and you got to raise the rent. It's the same thing. You know, inflation hits and I need to raise the rent because we get too comfortable in that 5K zone, that 10K zone, that marathon, that 50-mile, that 100-mile. It just becomes like that's the new normal for you. Like that's what I transitioned in my head, where it's like this is the new normal. And once it becomes the new normal, you start to go down, or myself, I start to go down these paths of, where I was in the past. So it's always like a progressive thing for me. And that's not to say that I do 100-milers or 200-milers every weekend, but that was the progression for me throughout, like I said, 2015 till now, where it was always that if I can do this, could I do that? And don't get me wrong, I've quote-unquote failed, at a first attempt, but sure. I'm always the type of person that says the only time you fail is when you stop going to actually do it. So, I don't want to paint this picture that everything that I've gone out to do that I've actually completed, but it's always pushing that next limit. And progressively, I just got to where I am now.
What are the logistics of running a 551-mile race?
A lot. and it's funny because for me, it was a lot, and for one person in particular, a good friend of mine who completed the same race in 2017, he had very little logistics. So I'll just preface it what I'm about to say by saying that what I did isn't necessary to complete it, but it does up your chances of completing it. So with the logistics that we had, so this race is called Infinitus. It's put on by the Endurance Society down in Goshen, Vermont. And it's a 27-ish mile figure eight loops course. And there's roughly, close to 4,000 feet of elevation gain on these trails, going up Mount Musumalu, Mount Romance, some of the trails down there. And so logistically, when I was preparing for that, it's how many miles am I going to do a day? What is my calorie intake going to be? What type of calories are we going to take in? When are we going to get sleep? And what do the breaks look like? And mm-hmm. So it was very regimented in the sense where when I came to the aid station, my crew that I had, some very, very big-hearted awesome, amazing friends to spend 10 days in the woods with me. I would come into the aid station. They would set a stopwatch. Okay, you have 10 minutes, and then you have to get back going. And at each aid station, we had a spreadsheet of what I was going to eat, and there was a few different options, and we broke it down by how many calories were in each, because we were shooting for 9,000 calories a day for that race. So we wanted to make sure that we hit that so we weren't in a calorie deficiency, along with hydration, making sure that I was taking in a specific amount of liters of water per hour, because when we started the race, it was 90 degrees. It was very, very hot. And I think by day three, it was snowing on the top of Mount Musumalu. So it's very easy to, like, drink when it's hot and then not drink when it's cold. You get into a calorie deficiency. You get dehydrated, and everything just falls apart from there. So having all those logistics all done and everything, that really helped my crew figure out, like, okay, Jay's coming in, and at this aid station, he's going to have X amount of calories, and we're going to make sure he's drinking X amount of water and then have his, you know, hydration formula.
I am totally stunned by how you've pushed the limits and impressed, and so glad that you shared your story with us. We only have about a minute left, but do you work with other soldiers who have returned from deployments, Jason?
I try to help anybody. Of course, being a veteran myself, yes, I can connect with military individuals a lot easier. But anybody who struggles with, you know, depression, PTSD, because PTSD comes in all forms.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always set out to help whoever I can, and whether that's through fitness, whether it's through, you know, guiding them to resources, or just being someone that they can call and yell at, or just have someone listen to them, or just go back and forth with. I try to do a lot. I do a lot with the Josh Pilato Fund out of Colchester, Vermont. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be putting on a race in December down at Suicide Six for Vermont Adaptive's Veterans Program. So there's a lot that I try to do to give back to the community as well.
We've had Josh's mom on the great fund, Josh's House. I'm glad you work with them. Jason Mozell is a network engineer at Dartmouth College. He runs ultramarathons. He has served our country with honor as a United States Marine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You take care. We're going to take a break for news. Then we'll be back as we switch from a veteran to a veterinarian. And today at 1 o'clock, it's Greg Hooker in the full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. And as these things happen, we had a guest call in sick. So we do have open phones right now. If you'd like to call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And we'll do our best to fill this next half hour and keep you entertained. We were hoping to talk to Dr. Bradley Temple, who is a veterinarian at the Springfield Animal Hospital. And the message that he and others who are in the Vermont Veterinary Medical Association are trying to get out is hope you can understand that right now, just like everything else we're going through, patience is required when you're making an an appointment for your cat or dog for just a wellness visit, or if it might be surgery. And there are a lot of factors right now that are affecting, you know, veterinary clinic scheduling. And some of them have had to do with, first of all, there was a backlog already before the pandemic started of some procedures, et cetera, for your pets. And then what happened next was the pandemic happened, and you had a couple factors. You had factors such as the need to sterilize the operating rooms and the patient rooms in between. So it slowed down, you know, the normal turnover between one pet and the next. If any of their staff did contract COVID, that also led to the staff being, you know, shorthanded and getting behind. And so these are some of the things that exacerbated what was already, you know, a bit of a slowdown. And we started to adopt more pets. And so, you know, that meant more visits. And maybe we can reschedule and talk to Dr. Bradley Temple at some point in the future. But I know he's very busy. As a matter of fact, we booked this about a month out, and and unfortunately, he's taken ill. So we do have open phones at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Yesterday, I had the most comprehensive list of anyone who might or could or should run for office next year, because things might start to switch around. We'll wait to hear, and hopefully we will get to talk to Representative Peter Welch next week sometime. You know, does he decide to leave his congressional seat and try to become the U.S. Senator, take over the seat that is vacated by Senator Leahy, who announced on Monday he will not seek re-election for another term, a ninth term. If that happens, the congressional seat opens up. You know, on the Republican side, does Governor Phil Scott run for the Senate seat? It is a big job, a real plum, but not sure that Governor Scott is interested in Washington politics. But if he is, then that opens the governor's spot. Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, one of those mentioned, if Peter Welch, you know, decides to go for the Senate seat, does she run for Congress? And if she does, that opens the lieutenant governor's position. So positions can be opened. One we know of right now is the U.S. Senate seat of Patrick Leahy, and that will draw certainly people from both sides of the aisle, probably independents, maybe a progressive, who will run. So we'll see what happens there. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, and as we do with open phones, you can also talk about anything you like. And let's go to Bambi in Sterling Brook. Hi, Bambi.
Hi. I just wanted to reiterate a challenge for vets in this state.
Sure.
You know, it's such a long state, and there are, you know, different vets who deal in different areas. And a few years ago, I got into a real problem with my sheep, and I called my vet, and he referred me to an emergency vet in Burlington. Well, when I called the Burlington, they said it would probably be 4 hours before they could get there. Well, my animal would have been dead in 4 hours. So I called the vet in Waterbury, and he told me that there was a mobile vet in Middlebury, or no, Middlesex. So I called them, and I'll tell you, I got a pager number. I paged the vet who had the mobile unit, and she showed up in 20 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
At my farm. And so I looked in that van. That van was set up for surgery. It was set up for, you know, all kinds of, you know, veterinarian problems that would have been, you know, necessary in the office, you know. So anyway, she was wonderful. It was Allison Cornwell, and she, I think it's Cornwell. Anyway, she was based in Middlesex. Well, she applied for a grant for this mobile van, and when it was, you know, when they denied her this grant, which was going to pay for the van, she absolutely gave up veterinarian and then sold that van to Alaska. So that Alaska, I mean, now Alaska has this wonderful, you know, mobile unit that can go all over the state with a pager. And I'm just really frustrated being, my vet is definitely a small animal vet, and he's about to retire. So, you know, there's no large animal vet available in this area, in the central Vermont area, that is, you know, has a partner or an employee that would be on call all the time. I mean, it's just like the emergency rooms at the, you know, the hospital.
That's right.
I mean, the vets are overwhelmed. And they're going to get sick just because they're trying to help everybody. But I just wanted to put that out because I talked to Anson Tevitz when he was on your program a few weeks ago or a month ago or something.
Yep.
And I just mentioned it, and he didn't even know about this mobile van, and he didn't know who issued the grant. My feeling is that it's either a co-op from Ohio or wherever that co-op is, and who hired or arranged for that grant to be fulfilled
initially.
But the caveat was that they had to live in St. Albans. Well, Allison didn't want to relocate from Middlesex. She had a great business, and she had a partner, and they took turns, you know, handling emergencies. And they didn't have an office. You know, they were in a house, I think, and they just had this pager that would page the van wherever it was, and it could have been, you know, it could have been over in Middlebury. It could have been, you know, up in St. Albans. It could have been, in my case, it's Morrisville.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, with the money that's coming in from the feds, if the state couldn't, you know, couldn't set up a system like that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there are young vets out there that are probably, you know, would love to have their own practice, like similar to Allison. I don't even know if she's living in the state anymore. But, you know, it was sad that she gave up her practice because, you know, they required her to live in St. Albans.
Well, Bambi, you bring up excellent points, so many actually in this phone call. But, you know, sometimes we think of veterinarians and, you know, most of us think of our household pets. But the need for the farm animals is immense, like so many other occupations. You know, dentistry, et cetera, in our rural areas in Vermont. We don't have the amount we need. And here you had someone who was filling a need with this mobile veterinary, I'll call it a hospital or clinic, who got to you in 20 minutes when you needed someone in 20 minutes, filled an incredible need. Now, there is, you also bring up the point, there's great funding coming in, ARPA funds, you might want to reach out to, I had her on Tuesday, Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, because she has, you know, been around the state getting input from Vermonters about how that money should be spent. The fact that you brought it up to Anson Tebbets and he didn't know, Sounds like there's a need that is going unmet and going unnoticed. And I would reach out to Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray about it, and I'll try to find out more information. Maybe we can do a show on it. But, Bambi, that is an excellent point, a wonderful phone call. Thank you for letting us know about it today.
Well, I appreciate the fact that that other person didn't show up, because I've been trying to find time to – I don't talk slow, so
– You did a great job.
It's just, it takes time to work out these problems, and yeah. I think it should be put in the bucket so that the legislature knows how, desperate we are for all our support systems, even the slaughterhouses and the, wool processing. Yeah. I mean, it's just incredible what support systems these farms, everybody needs, and they tend to just deal with the farmer, which is important, absolutely. But if he doesn't have the support from,
he or she.
Place to, slaughter his animals, or to, have, care in, in a timely manner. And what brought it up was I have border collies for my sheep, and my border collie, Fergus, got lost when he was out mushrooming with my son, and he stayed out overnight. And when Scott picked him up the next day on somebody's porch up in Mud City, he seemed fine. Well, within 2 days, he spiked a temperature of 107, and they could not bring him back. And this poor dog had gotten tangled in a piece of baling twine from the 1800s or something. Baling twine. What is it? That kind of fencing with the barbed wire fence.
Oh, barbed wire.
It got into a barbed wire fence that must have been, at least 100 years old, because it was solid rust. But we didn't notice that at all until we took him. I just told my son to take the dog down and park in the vet's parking lot until they come and see him.
Bambi, I'm going to have to take a break here. I love this call. Thank you so much for calling this to our attention.
Well, I don't mean to take up all your time, but
you were great.
Your being there, and you have a great program.
All right. I'm going to see what we can do about that, Bambi. I just heard from Bambi up in Morrisville, and you know the dog that she was referring to. I've got John Wilson in here, host of Dinner Jazz, and we're going to talk about something else, but you know that dog that she talked about.
Her son Scotty comes over to the house all the time, and usually in the morning hours, and I got to know him. I always knew him from skiing and being around the Stowe area, and great guy. But really got to know him during the pandemic. He would come and sort of look in on my neighbors. He had a friend who was going through an illness, and just a good, kind person. And also he was looking at my dog. I have a dog we inherited during the pandemic, right at the beginning, where somebody said, "Can you watch our dog tonight?" The lockdown began the next day.
Oh, my goodness.
And we've had her ever since. Yeah, Snowflake Bella Luna. She's the hit of the neighborhood. But I've often thought she might have a better life over there at Bambi's farm. Who knows?
All right. Well, we'll see if where
that goes.
Snowflake Bella Luna winds up.
Snowflake Bella Luna.
Now, John not only hosts jazz, but John is. Are you a crooner? Is that how I would? You're a crooner of sorts, right?
I think
right?
so. I've come to embrace that. We were often would say, I'm a jazz singer.
Yep.
I found that could be a little bit alienating when you say jazz. Some folks, it's not as marketable as it should be. And I thought, what do we really do? I play with John LaRouche, a great chromatic harmonica player from Callis. Sometimes Michael Arnowitt. Levent Yanal, and more closer to home is Greg Nichols.
Mm.
Greg Nichols also plays with his wife Jane Evans, and she noticed we were talking that when you say jazz, sometimes the folks who are doing the booking, their eyes kind of glaze over, and they sort of expect it to be one kind of thing. But really, what we do is, when I looked at it, the 20th century.
Well, it's interesting.
That era, yeah.
Yesterday I had Eugene Human on from the Vermont Jazz Center down in Brattleboro.
Oh, sure.
And it was a great interview. Boy, wouldn't it be great to live close by to that. And, every time they've got somebody playing, you could pop in. But I heard from a listener named John who sent me, alerted me to something I did not know about. If you go to YouTube and search live from Emmett's Place, Emmett Cohen, amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Piano player, and he has been since the pandemic started. It was just supposed to be something they did, you know, a few times, but it's gone on now for 74 weeks. But in his apartment in New York City, jazz musicians get together and play and jam, and it is absolutely stunning.
His sister's a really good clarinet player.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Now, John, you've cooked up something. I know you've done in the past, you have gone and people could hire you to do like singing grams. You'd show up
and sing somebody's favorite song.
Right.
I've done that. About 20 times.
Uh-huh.
It is a wonderful gift. Thank you. I've had a hard time selling it. sometimes it's easier to do than to sell something. But Valentine's Day and Christmas seem to be the two.
Not all great ideas are necessarily great business ideas.
Exactly.
That's the one thing we should keep in mind. But I still love that you do it. But you have also done something else. It's the Sinatra thing. So tell people about that.
Well, it's I got the idea just knowing all of Sinatra's songs. One of the very first jobs I had in radio was playing the Sounds of Sinatra, this syndicated program that we had here on Sunday nights. And nice little alliteration there.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds of Sinatra, syndicated Sunday nights. And just from knowing these songs, I began to hear how the harmonies mix together, and how throughout his whole career there are these themes that continue in both melody and lyrical ideas and all that. And I put together, I guess you'd call it a musical suite. And I wanted to limit it, because I could have gone on forever, to a certain amount of time. So I picked 45, and then I thought, well, you can kind of do 45 of his songs in that time frame, allow a little extra time for the more emotional ones like One for My Baby or I'm a Fool to Want You.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to rush through those. But most of them, like the Coffee Song or Fly Me to the Moon, you know, they hum right along. They're done in about 30 seconds if you just sing it through without the solos for Basie and everybody. So, so I came up with the Sinatra 45, and I've performed it I try to do it on his birthday, December 12th, and that's coming up. And I'm looking for a place to perform it. If I have to, I'll do it on Main Street on Stowe on his birthday, where I've sung before in front of the gondola they have out there. But I've done it at the Waterbury Grange, was one of the first one-man shows they had. Also at the Matterhorn in Stowe, two nightclub shows. Also at Idle Time, the Idle Time Brewery there.
Yeah.
And, just get up and start singing. And try to do it with the proper amount of emotion, but also keep it within that time frame. Because you are asking a lot of people to just sit there and watch somebody sing, you know, without a musical accompaniment or anything like that.
Right.
You have to have an interest in the music, I think, for it to all sort of click. But after the first time I did it, I thought, you know, it'd be better with a band, but why not just do it?
Yeah. Do you go just song to song? Do you stop in between every once in a while and talk, or do you just?
Sometimes. I allow myself, let's see, I have the set list here. I just finished it on Lee's computer.
I mean, of course, in music, 45 is a magic number.
That's
we grew up buying 45s.
45.
So 45 songs and 45.
Minute.
Exactly.
Yep.
Brilliant.
That's why songs used to be 2 minutes and 30 seconds almost. 245 almost
right.
Entirely. But I allow myself songs 25 through 43 to sort of just go spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And just see what comes to me in the moment.
Like a true jazz man.
Yeah, and that's what I draw from. Things like All the Things You Are and things from The Real Book and The Great American Songbook, My Funny Valentine. You know, those are ones that are locked and loaded in memory. But there are some that are just important that you can't not do My Way.
Right.
You can't not do, I think, songs like Come Fly With Me.
Right.
And then there's other ones like The Night We Called It a Day. Bob Dylan just covered that.
Oh, no kidding.
On his, Shadows in the Night, his Sinatra CD.
Wow. Have you ever visited Hoboken, New Jersey, the home of Frank Sinatra?
Does he have a setup like Elvis? You know, like
I doubt it.
I don't think
he spent a ton of time after he.
I don't think so. No.
Got big. I've been to Hoboken. Great pizza.
Hey.
You could Yeah, you should make the trek just to see the haunts where he grew up. All right, we're going to take a break. That's John Wilson, and you can hear Dinner Jazz. Not tonight, though. We've
not
got
tonight.
The Pats.
We have the Pats.
And tomorrow night we have hockey. So, all right, next week. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to meet a Vermont Olympian who took double equestrian gold at Montreal in 1976, who now creates saddles to help horses and riders. And that reminder, tonight, 5:30, our Pats coverage begins. And then the Patriots face the Atlanta Falcons starting at 8:30. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Yeah, just when I think I know absolutely everything about Vermont, I stumble upon something or someone I should have heard of by now and of their accomplishments. Now, keep in mind, I've only been around since 2003, so my institutional knowledge is only so deep. But I was Google mapping the valley for some reason. I spotted a company called Tad Coffin Performance Saddles. Right away, I think, what and who is this? Both are incredibly interesting, and I couldn't wait for you all to hear his Olympic story and the saddle business that he's built in the aftermath. And Tad Coffin joins us now. Tad, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, sir. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to have you. Listeners, to ask Tad about his equestrian career or about his saddles, our numbers are 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Tad, when did you start riding and when did you start riding competitively?
Well, I need to make a quick disclaimer. Mine first out in the field in beautiful Virginia where I live, and it's nearly 70 degrees. So I don't know what the weather's like in Vermont, but this is pretty nice down here.
Gorgeous.
So I grew up
50s.
On Long Island. I'm sorry?
Gorgeous in 50s right now, so not too bad.
Yes, well, that's good. Good.
Yeah.
So I grew up riding on Long Island. My mother was an avid horsewoman, and I come from a sort of an equestrian family of sorts on the one side. And one of the things that got me started in the sport that I ended up competing in the Olympics was trips to Vermont in the summer, where I was fortunate enough to go to the Green Mountain Horse Association.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if it's still ongoing. I believe it is. But that really got my start in the sport that I had so much success in.
Tad, so, you broke up there just when you told the Vermont story. So tell us again. You came up in the summer, and who did you work with, and where did you ride up here?
In the summer, we used to come to Vermont to a little town called Stratford, which is where my parents ended up moving to, and I participated in the Green Mountain Horse Association Pony Club Clinic, which is in South Woodstock, Vermont. And that was my entree into the sport that I ended up having so much success in.
Well,
so it's a wonderful Vermont connection.
Yeah, it is a wonderful Vermont connection. What are the various equestrian events that you competed in?
So the one that I competed in is called the 3-day event. It's essentially a triathlon, equestrian triathlon, where you do three individual sports at a lower level than they actually exist individually in the Olympic Games themselves. But you do a dressage test the first day, cross-country event on the second day, and some stadium jumping on the third day. And it's essentially a sport that was fashioned after the military keeping military chargers fitting on their toes in between wars. So the idea was the first day you showed your ability to have your horse under control on parade grounds, and the second day you showed your ability to go across country and take a message over a fairly rigorous kind of terrain, and the third day was to show that the way you did the second day didn't incapacitate you or your horse, so that you were able to continue in service. So that's the basic idea. It's certainly evolved since then, but that's the effort behind it.
And Tad, those are three very different events. Normally, I don't think you'd have a dressage horse also competing in show jumping, but you would use the same horse during the three-day eventing?
That's correct. It's really a test of all-around horsemanship and all-around capabilities of a particular horse. So you need a horse that's level-headed but has some blood that they can really run and jump, and then they've got to have some stamina, and they've got to have a lot of qualities of soundness and endurance. So that's the test of the all-around equestrian athlete.
Well, tell us about the horse you rode in those events in the Olympics in Montreal.
So it was a wonderful, very very talented mare, which is unusual in itself. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that was so extraordinary about her is that she was never thought of as an Olympic horse. The idea behind her beginning was that she was, the thinking behind the people that bred her was that she would be an Olympic horse. But she was relatively small and not particularly athletic, and never showed the kind of scope and dynamic athletic ability that you would think of an Olympic horse. But every time you asked her to do something, she managed to do it. So if you asked her to jump 3 feet, she jumped 3 feet, and you thought, well, that's good. That's about what she can do. And then if you raised it to 3'6", well, she jumped 3'6", and you thought, well, that's about what she can do. And raised it a little bit more, then she just kept doing what she was asked to do. She had what I would say that she did have is a fairly narrow set of parameters of her ability. So she needed to be trained very carefully, which was, she was trained in an extraordinary way by our coach at the time, Jack Legoff, who was just a genius. And she had to be ridden fairly carefully. So, you couldn't ask her to, do a lot more than the test that was required. So she was capable of making the time on a particular course, but if you ended up a minute under time because you went too fast, you were going to be in trouble. So anyway,
the accomplishment of reaching the Olympics, winning double gold, so few people have ever experienced that. So what was it like to get to Montreal, to have that gold medal around your neck, and to hear your national anthem playing?
Well, it's an extraordinary honor to do anything for this country. But I would say, before delving into the answer to that more specifically, I would say that one of the things that always attracted me about the Olympics was the nobility of the idea. And I think that that's an important concept. I think that humans are meant to strive for something that's noble, regardless of whatever particular endeavor it is. If it's a noble endeavor, there's something intrinsically valuable about that for the human spirit. And I think the Olympics spoke to me partly because my family was very political, and I thought that here's a way that people of all stripes and all nationalities can get together, and politics can get out of the way, and people can just compete in sports which they love and be in pursuit of excellence. So that was a very appealing idea to me, and it still is a very appealing idea. And I think that you can argue that the Olympics have been corrupted by money and commercial interests, but the very nobility of the idea still exists.
So I agree.
That's the first thing.
Yeah, touche.
The the thing that, to answer your question, what does that feel like? It's, you know, it's an extraordinary moment, and you're right, it's a very rarefied moment, because in Olympics it comes around once every 4 years. So, you know, over the course of the equestrian Olympic games, there have been very few gold medalists. We've had four in this country, so that's a pretty small group. So obviously it's a remarkable honor. I think one of the things that it also has to be said is that, you know, when you're competing at that level, you compete successfully if you have extraordinary focus. You know, you have to, particularly in our sport, you've got to be focused over 3 or 4 days with a level of intensity that is, I would say, trained into you, or is in part of your personality and part of your training. So you're trained to exclude all kinds of other peripheral experiences so that you can stay focused on your job. So looking back over 45 years, I can say that, you know, a lot of the experience I was unaware of because I was particularly focused on my job, which is what I was supposed to be focused on.
Yeah.
So, you know, standing on the medal podium is, you know, and hearing the national anthem is just the thought of it sends chills down my spine. But, you know, a lot of the other experience about the Olympics, I'm not as aware of as the people who are actually there spectating, because I was too busy focused on what I was doing.
Tad, when did you get into the saddle business?
Well, I first had my experience with saddles from a manufacturing standpoint right after the Olympic Games, when I was asked by a prominent saddle manufacturer in England to endorse a saddle. You know, that's not that unusual after some Olympic success. So, you know, I did that, and I did a little bit differently. I went to England and I worked with the manufacturer, and I had some ideas of things that I would like to do. And you know, one of the things I gained from that was a real eye into, a real perspective into how saddles are developed and how they're made and who makes them and what's behind it. And one of the things that I was immediately impressed by is that the people that make saddles don't ride, and the people that ride don't make saddles. And there's sort of a gulf of, I would say, a gulf of misunderstanding between the two. And that was my initial foray. So, you know, we did a few things differently and had some success. And, you know, that seemed to suffice for some time, until it didn't. And then I had to go at it a little bit differently.
Well, tell us give us an overview of your company, Tad Coffin Performance Saddles.
Well, I think one of the features of our company that's unique is that we're primarily interested in investigating the answers to some questions that I think have not been thoroughly looked into, such as how responsible is a saddle for horses' performance? How responsible is a saddle for horses' lack of performance? You know, what would an ideal saddle do for a horse if one could make it? What would it be different for every single horse? Would it be the same? And if we really change the paradigm of how a saddle is made and how it's constructed and how it's designed, what would the outcome of that be on horse performance and on rider performance, and how much of the lack of cooperation there is oftentimes between a horse and rider would disappear? So to answer those questions, we've developed a scenario which is ideal in my way of thinking for providing more insight. So we have a manufacturing operation at the end of a large building, and at the other end there are a group of horses And the purpose of those horses is solely to give me feedback on whatever experiments we're making in a particular day. And in order to have those experiments be worthwhile, the horses have to have lots of controls on the variables in their life. So, you know, we don't have horses on any medications. We don't use any pharmaceuticals. We don't use supplements. We don't use any kind of therapies. You know, these are really clean horses from the data perspective, so that if we change something in the saddle, we can register a reaction from the horse and know that that's most likely to be the result of the change that we made in the saddle. And so we've been doing this for 30 years now, and we've made over 4,500 experiments, which is more than it's ever been done in the history of saddle making. And we've answered some questions, and we've asked many, many more. So I would say that the whole process has been more like question propagation rather than than question answering. Mm-hmm. Because every bit of knowledge that you add to the island of knowledge, you increase the shoreline of wonder. And I think that's sort of the way we've gone about it. And in order to make our research valid, you know, we sell saddles, and our customers become part of the inquiry process. And as we go along, we've just learned a tremendous amount. And the idea was to figure out whether we could make a saddle that had a biomechanical advantage. Because when you think about it, you know, the saddle is the interface between horse and rider, and you can describe a horse and a rider as a complex engineering system, or two separate complex engineering systems, because, you know, we've never made a robot that can duplicate what either a horse or a rider can do.
Right.
So if you've got an interface between these two complicated engineering systems and it's rudimentary, then the performance of the complex engineering system is going to be degraded. So, the first question is, can you bring a saddle sort of up to speed as an interface? The reality is that saddle design has changed very little in decades, if not in centuries. And I think that we can do better. And I think our horses deserve us to do better. And we have to investigate. And the problem with it is it's complicated. You know, the solution or the answer to any of these questions are not obvious. So, you know, as you start to get into it, you know, the saddle has many component parts, and you have to think, well, you know, if this horse is being bothered by one saddle and I put another saddle on him and he's better, then several questions arise from that. What about that saddle made that horse go better? And what about the other saddle made him go worse? And, you know, which of the many components inside the saddle is responsible? Is it one of the components, or is it all of the components? So, you know, as I said, the answer to these things are not obvious, and you have to be prepared to do a lot of investigation, which is what we've done.
That's fascinating. We only have about 2.5 minutes left. I do want to ask you about a piece that you've created called TheraTree. What is this?
So it's the same technology that it's in our saddle. And just to give you a quick snapshot, one of the things that we discovered as we were working on something for a biomechanical advantage is that we ended up completely by accident creating a scenario whereby the saddle tree, which is a structure inside, is creating a beneficial electromagnetic field. It's strange stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you think the saddle is complicated, this is more so. But anyway, there's an energy component which has an effect on the horse's well-being and human well-being as well, as best we can tell. Mm-hmm. And it's both in our saddles, and it's in a standalone device that we use for therapy and well-being. There's a lot of good information on our website about it, but it's really, really wondrous and fascinating stuff.
Yeah, the website is tadcoffinsaddles.com, and there is great information. How long did you ride competitively after the Olympics, or do you still, Tad?
No, I don't ride competitively, but I ride 3 or 4 horses every day. It's a very important part of the process, and I believe I stopped riding competitively sometime around 81, and I did a little bit in a different discipline for a while up through the 90s. But ever since 92, when I've been investigating saddles, I've been riding a lot, but it's limited to this endeavor of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And coaching as well?
No, I don't do anything but what I'm working on with saddles. And I would like to give a shout out, and this is somebody who I think you should look into as a possible interview, is a guy by the name of Eric Darnell, who helped me tremendously get started in the saddle industry. And he's also in Stratford, Vermont. He's a world champion boomerang thrower. I think he's 5-time world champion boomerang thrower and 1 time as a national coach. And he essentially imbued me with a sense of you know, confidence to go ahead and investigate something that had never been investigated before. And without his help, I would be nowhere. So Vermont is instrumental both in terms of me getting into the business that I'm in and also in the sport that I'm in. And there was another gentleman by the name of Denny Emerson, who was also in Stratford, who's an international rider and very well renowned. And he's the one at age, when I was 16, he thought, you know, you should try to do this. You should try to compete at the Olympic Games. So I'm really indebted to all of the Vermonters that have been so instrumental in both my athletic career and also my current career.
Outstanding.
So, thank you, Vermont.
Thank you, Tad Coffin, winner of 2 gold medals in the 1976 Olympics in individual eventing and team eventing. He now owns Tad Coffin Performance Saddles. And again, that website is tadcoffinsaddles.com. Tad, thank you so much for sharing your story with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you.
All right. You take care. All right. That's our show for today. I'm off tomorrow. You've got Governor Jim Douglas as your host. I'll meet you back here on Monday.